The bathhouse was at the rear of the palace and was surrounded by tidily trimmed thickets and little rock gardens. From the exterior, it looked like a storage building made of stone and wood. Grant entered, ducking his head beneath the low doorway, and saw polished wood floors, benches, and a large above-ground tub. The far wall was made of the oiled paper and laths he had seen in the other parts of the fortress. The circular tub was about 10 feet in diameter, with a bench running around the inside, all of it made of planks of seasoned hardwood and sealed with pitch. It rose 3 feet above the floor. As Grant entered, he saw that it was already 3/4 full. Two girls poured buckets of steaming water into it. They were small and petite, wearing loosely woven shifts that left their arms and most of their legs bare. They bowed to him as he entered, and by hand gestures indicated he should disrobe. He unlaced his boots and stepped out of them. After he shrugged out of his shirt, he stood and waited as one of the girls topped off the tub with a final bucket of water. The other one tugged at his pants. Grant glowered down at her and held her small hand where it was. She looked up at him and said a few words in an exasperated tone, gesturing to the tub with her other hand. Grant told himself he wasn't the first naked man they'd ever seen, and probably wouldn't be the last. Reluctantly, he unbuckled his belt, undid the snaps on his trousers, and dropped them as well as his underwear. Both girls gazed at him for a long, silent moment, their dark eyes widening as far as the epicanthic folds allowed. They quickly averted their faces, giggling into their hands. Grant felt a hot flush of irritation and embarrassment spread up his neck. Then the truth dawned on him. The girls had never seen a gaijin male unclothed before, and he guessed that the average penile size of their men was more than likely in direct proportion to their bodies. Grant wasn't a small man, regardless of how he was measured, either in height, breadth, length, or thickness. To them, he must have seemed like a giant out of one of their legends, in more ways than one. He climbed into the tub and sat on the bench, making shooing motions with his hands. Rather reluctantly, the two girls left the room. He splashed water over his face and chest. His joints were stiff, his muscles aching. A dull headache throbbed at the back of his skull. Leaning over the edge of the tub, he removed his straight razor from the kit bag. After a few minutes of insistent arguing earlier in the day, Shizuka had arranged for the return of his bag. It was waiting for him when he awoke from his day-long slumber. When he passed Bridget on the way back from the bathhouse, they spoke for a couple of minutes, both of them hoping that when and if dinner was served, it would be a bit more substantial than bean curd and rice. Covering his face in soap suds, he shaved away more than a week's worth of whiskers from his face. He rarely used the razor as a personal grooming tool. He usually carried it out in the field as a hideout weapon, a way to cut and slash high odds down to his favor. He rinsed his face and filled a bucketful of water and let it trickle across the back of his neck, the muscles of which felt like clenched fists. Even sleeping for nearly 8 hours hadn't relaxed him. He poured more water over his head, hoping it would wash away the residue of his dreams. He couldn't really remember them, but he knew Domi figured in them prominently. Although Grant had witnessed the deaths of many people, he still would not have been surprised if she popped her white-haired head up above the rim of the tub. He told himself she never would. The dead never returned to life like that. Leaning back, arms propped on the edge of the tub, he was content to soak and doze for what seemed like an hour. When fingers touched the back of his neck, his body snapped taut like a bowstring and he spun on the bench, sloshing water out of the tub.
Do you wish me to massage you?
Grant expected to see one of the serving girls. His mouth gaped open when he saw Shizuka standing there, backlit by the lantern. She was dressed in the same short white linen shift as the female attendants, and with her raven hair hanging loose and free, she was heart-wrenchingly lovely. His blood seemed to race through his arteries like stampeding horses. Grant tried to sound casual, but he knew he failed at it.
If you have nothing better to do.
I don't.
Grant put his back against the wall of the tub, and she leaned into him, working at the thick muscles of his neck and shoulders with surprisingly strong, practiced fingers. As she kneaded the tendons, he felt the soft brush of her hair against his bare shoulder. Within minutes, the pressure of her fingertips pushed out the stiffness and undid the knots in his muscles. He noticed his headache was receding as well.
I can make it as prolonged or as delightful as you wish.
Let's just see how it goes.
He felt the gentle touch of her soft, bud-like lips as Shizuka kissed the side of his neck. Her hands went around him to his chest, and he felt the teasing pressure of her breasts pressing against his back. Her hands trailed across his chest, one sharp nail tracing a thin line over his belly. Grant caught his breath sharply, and her hand paused.
What is it?
Her dark eyes looked liquid. He felt his muscles tightening under her touch.
It's been a long time for me, Shizuka. A very long time. And I don't know if this is the right time.
You feel you would be unfaithful to your little ghost girl?
No. Yes. No, there was nothing like this between us.
Shizuka kissed the side of his face.
What was between you then?
Grant shifted uncomfortably on the bench as his penis engorged and thickened. He tried to ignore it as he began to talk. He rarely spoke of his past, of personal matters, but now he told her of his life. He spoke of his youth in Cobaltville, of his heritage as a magistrate, and how he abided by the family tradition to become one himself. He told her of his many long years as a spiritually and legally sanctioned killer, using only violence to impose order on the Baron's definition of chaos. His voice low, he described some of his bloody deeds as a mag and the wounds he incurred, not only of body but of soul. When he spoke of Olivia, he cursed the slight quaver in his voice, and he noticed how Shizuka's lips pursed momentarily. He told her of his many uncertainties in life, but revealed to her the one thing he was certain of. Sooner or later, pain or death, or both, came to all who got too close to him. Shizuka shook her head and pressed her cheek against the side of his face.
A sad tale, grandson.
He forced a lopsided grin.
Compared to some of the suffering I've seen, it's not sad at all.
Shizuka kissed him, her lips moving from his cheek to his lips.
But still, your warrior's heart suffers. Let me ease it a bit.
Shizuka's fingers trailed down his belly again to his groin. They found his erection, and she let out a brief, startled murmur. Her hand encircled his shaft, hefting him, measuring him with curious but gentle fingers. Shizuka undid the drawstrings on her shift and gracefully slid out of it, at the same time she slid over the rim of the tub.
Is this part of the samurai code?
She caught his hand.
I'm amending it, just this once.
Shizuka guided his hand to the firm swell of her small but perfectly shaped breast. He felt the gem-hard nipple pressing against his calloused palm. Leaning forward, he kissed her yielding mouth as he ran his free hand over the smooth, taut skin of her shoulders. Then, the same mad passion that had consumed him on the night they had first met after the battle with the Cobaltville magistrates engulfed him again. He showered her face, throat, and breasts with kisses. Panting, Shizuka straddled his thighs, putting her knees on the bench. Clasping her hands at the back of his neck, her forearms resting on the broad yoke of his shoulders, she began lowering herself on him. When he felt her velvety warmth on the swollen tip of his shaft, he couldn't repress a groan. Shizuka groaned too, as she worked his rock-hard length into her. Her hips moved back and forth. She bit her lower lip, her face a mask of concentration. When he was fully embedded within the heat of her, Grant cradled her buttocks with his big hands and set a steady rhythm, lifting her up to him while he lunged upward with his hips. Voicing a keening cry, Shizuka thrust up and down, gasping, whimpering, and moaning. She clutched at his biceps, her fingernails digging into the flesh. Steam and lust and sweat blinded him. He tongued the desire-hard nipples of her breasts, and her body suddenly stiffened. Back arching, she convulsed and shuddered in a spasming orgasm so fierce and unrestrained that Grant began trembling in a contraction. Gripping her tightly by the waist, he burst deep inside her, an eruption of liquid fire that seemed to last forever. Brandt embraced her, while both of them trembled through the aftermath of their mutual release. His senses slowly returned to him, and Shizuka breathed a long, final sigh of satisfaction.
Ah, Grant-san, I am so glad the winds of fate blew you here.
Her liquid brown eyes gazed steadily into his.
Me too. Even if I didn't have anything in mind except to get a bath.
He smiled.
I think I'll rest for a minute or 10.
She pulled away from him and leaned against the side of the tub, her head tilted back, eyes closed. Grant waited until his respiration had returned to normal, then climbed out of the tub. He took a towel from a bench and rubbed his chest and shoulders dry. As he turned to hand the towel to her, Shoki came through the door in a lunge. Kane straight-armed Bridget out of the path of the black-garbed man. He dived for the futon and the blaster hidden beneath it. The swordsman launched himself forward, the long, slightly curved blade cutting a whipping path through the air toward his head. Kane managed to drop to a half-crouch and duck as the katana slashed over his head. Snatching at the futon, he yanked it from the floor and flung it at the hooded assassin. The sword edge hacked through it, sending up a spray of chicken feathers. He stabbed his hand out for the Mustang 380, but the katana chopped into the floor a quarter of an inch from his middle finger. As Kane threw himself backward, the man kicked out with a slippered foot and sent the blaster skittering across the room. Kane managed to grab the wooden block pillow, and he held it before him between both hands. A snarling, contemptuous laugh issued from beneath the black hood. The katana rose and fell in a lightning-quick motion, and the pillow fell from Kane's hands, sliced neatly in two. The assassin spun gracefully on the ball of one foot and thrust the sword at Kane's midsection. Kane sidestepped, feeling the blade cut through his shirt right over his left ribs. As the blade cut a flat arc toward his throat, Kane flung himself across the room in a backward somersault, rolling into a ball to make himself a smaller target. Then muzzle flashes strobed in the gathering shadows of the room and three shots cracked, one following the other so closely they sounded like a single report. The thunder of the gunfire was deafening. The flimsy walls of the room beat it back and magnified it. The swordsman jerked and doubled over, bleeding from three wounds in his belly. He fell face down, barely 2 feet from Kane's position on the floor, rendered unconscious by the shock of the triple shots fired at such close quarters. It was Bridget, holding the Mustang in a double-handed grip, her legs spread wide in a combat stance.
So, you smuggled in a blaster.
Kane rose to his feet and fanned away a wisp of cordite smoke.
Good thing, too. Looks like the Black Dragons weren't so much offended by the idea of Gaijin carrying weapons in the palace as encouraged by the fact we weren't.
Bridget eyed the pistol curiously.
Where'd you get this?
Kane picked up the dead man's sword and hefted it, testing its balance.
A small memento of Area 51. Did you say Grant was in the bathhouse?
If the Black Dragons are planning to sweep all foreigners from New Edo, they'll be after him, too.
Kane didn't waste time putting on his boots. He opened the door a crack and peered out into the dimly lit corridor. It appeared empty and sepulchrally quiet. It was still early evening, and all the lamps had yet to be lit.
We don't know if Takaun himself is behind this. Regardless, we've got to find where they're keeping our weapons.
Bridget took up position on the other side of the door.
We'd better find Grant first.
Kane nodded, slid the door open, and stepped out into the hallway. He took the point, padding along barefoot with Bridget bringing up the rear, blaster held with its barrel pointed toward the ceiling. They had progressed less than a dozen yards when a side door opened and a black kimonoed figure stepped out into the hallway. Light glinted along the length of his sword. Kane and Bridget halted as the figure moved gracefully toward him.
Want me to plug him?
No. At least not now. We may need all the rounds later.
He didn't show his surprise at Bridget's sudden willingness to employ violence. He raised his voice.
Do you speak English?
Hi.
The response sounded as if a teenager had spoken.
I know your vile tongue, Gaijin. We Black Dragons can barely speak a word of it without vomiting.
Then you don't have to say anything. Just listen. I don't want any trouble with your society. Let me pass, and we'll leave New Edo right now.
The Black Dragon eased closer, and Kane saw he looked to be about 17 years old. His face was smooth and unlined, but his dark eyes glinted with a fanatic's fervor.
It's too late for that. We must send a message, not just to other Gaijin lovers on our island, but to the Daimyo himself.
He said nothing more. Kane set himself, and his youthful opponent moved immediately to the attack. His blade work was fast, but his technique was not as good or clever as other samurai Kane had seen. Still, it required all of Kane's speed and reflexes to keep the Black Dragon's glittering blade from breaking through his guard.
This isn't necessary.
The Black Dragon paid no attention to him. He made a sideways slice that Kane blocked. Then he stepped in close, his katana locking against the other man's blade, freezing it in position. His opponent's face was a mask of complete strain as he strove to break contact, but Kane didn't relent with the pressure. The young man was faster than he, but Kane was by far the stronger. Kane shoved him backward down the hallway and then stepped back. The unexpected release of resistance caused the young man to stumble, and as he regained his balance and made a clumsy thrust with his blade, Kane dropped to one knee and plunged his katana into the Black Dragon's lower belly. The Black Dragon simply shuddered and died. Kane stood, and the young man's body slid wetly down his blade. Without looking at Bridget, he started down the hallway again. As he reached the door leading to the outside, he saw three dark shapes creeping across the lawn. One turned toward him, and he heard a semi-musical twang. He dropped to a crouch just in time to avoid an arrow that whistled over his head. Bridget fired the Mustang through one of the paper panels, and Kane saw one of the shadow shapes clutch himself and fall heavily. Kane made a move to step outside again, but a man standing just outside the door reacted to the rustle of his clothes and slashed out with a katana. Kane kicked himself backward as Bridget leveled the blaster. The round took the man in the right shoulder. The sound of the steel-jacketed slug smacking into flesh was ugly, but the awful animal howl he uttered was worse. The wounded man lurched across the lawn, wild with pain, dazed from the shock of impact. He screamed a long string of indecipherable words. A dozen helmeted men in body armor and armed with katanas came running through the open gate. Black-robed figures, long blades glittering in the last rays of daylight, rushed to intercept them. Then figures were shouting and swearing and running all across the lawn. The Black Dragons attacked the Tigers of Heaven, fighting stubbornly and skillfully, for they had nothing to lose, and therefore everything to fight for. Shoki's slippered feet were silent against the polished cedar floor. Grant caught only a whisper of sound, a glimpse of a flitting shadow. He rolled away, flinging himself clear as Shoki hurtled through the air, driving down with his Naginata. The curved blade buried itself in the edge of the tub, inches from Grant's right arm. In that peculiar slowing of time perception in combat, Grant saw everything at once. Shoki's face was twisted with savage anger. Shizuka pressed against the wall of the tub, her eyes wide in shock. The flame of the lantern flickered in the breeze, wafting in through the open door. Grant saw it all in a single shaved sliver of a second. While his mind registered it, his body reacted to the attack. As Shoki tried to free his blade from the tub, Grant punched him with his right fist on the point of the samurai's chin. The idea was to break his damn neck with one blow, but Shoki released the long handle of the Naginata and rolled with the blow. He staggered half the length of the room, but managed to retain his balance. Grant coiled the muscles in his legs and bounded forward, his broad, bare chest colliding violently with that of the Japanese man. Arms windmilling, Shoki was catapulted backward through the rear wall, taking laths and oiled paper squares with him in a loud, clattering crash. The air was nearly driven from his lungs, but he got to his feet again, kicking and tearing his way through the wreckage to renew the attack. Shizuka shouted shrill words at him, but the man paid her no attention. He launched a straight leg kick at Grant's exposed genitals, but Grant turned sideways and the foot landed on his upper thigh, not his groin. Still, the impact hurt, and in response, he hooked a punishing right fist into the samurai's ribs. He heard the crunch of bone, and the Japanese staggered back with a grunt of pained surprise. Grant moved after him, not wanting to let the man regain his balance or find a new weapon. Shoki kicked out at his groin again, and then at his kneecaps. Grant sidestepped the first kick, but the second one landed on his shin, peeling the flesh up over the bone.
Ah, you little prick!
He kicked out himself, but Shoki dived aside. His dive brought him back to the tub, where he closed his hands around the handle of his Naginata. He wrenched the blade loose from the wood, but Grant leaped on him like a panther. His right hand encircled Shoki's wrist, and he put his left arm around the man's neck as he drove his knee into the base of the samurai's spine. Shoki screamed in pain, but managed to slam the blunt butt end of his weapon hard into Grant's lower belly. Air left Grant's lungs in an agonized grunt, and his grip loosened. Choki wriggled free and spun, raising the Naginata for an overhead blow in order to split Grant's skull like a melon. Shizuka chose that instant to vault over the edge of the tub, water trailing from her naked limbs. Both of her feet struck Choki between his shoulder blades, and he stumbled forward, his back arched. The blade hissed down and chopped into the floor, barely a finger's width from the tip of Grant's big toe. Choki pulled it free and began circling Grant slowly. He growled at Shizuka.
Stay back!
Grant couldn't afford to have his attention divided. One wrong move, one misstep, and he was dead. Or at the very least, grievously wounded by a castrating scythe-like sweep of the Naginata. When Shoki pretended to slash at Grant's groin, the big man took the feint and cursed himself an instant later when the samurai shifted in mid-motion and hacked at his throat. Grant ducked, but he felt the passage of the blade over his head, so close he wouldn't have been surprised if it shaved off a few twists of his hair.
Hiretsukan!
Grant didn't know what it meant, but he assumed it wasn't an endearment. Shoki crab-stepped forward, trying a different tactic, whipping the blunt end of the Naginata toward Grant's throat. Lifting his hands, he crossed his wrists and caught the end of the wooden shaft between them. Grasping it tightly, he pivoted and yanked the weapon from Shoki's grasp. He howled as the pole slid through his hands, inflicting painful friction burns on both palms. Grant tossed it aside and advanced on the samurai, half expecting him to flee. Instead, Shoki leaped forward, bending diagonally at the waist. He extended his leg straight out, and the sole of his foot thudded solidly into Grant's midsection. Air left his lungs in a loud whoosh, and he stumbled, off balance. Shoki followed through with his leap, chopping with the edge of his hand at the base of Grant's neck. Although his hand rebounded from the thick ropes of neck muscle, the impact caused little pinwheels to ignite behind Grant's eyes. Before they stopped whirling, Shoki secured a stranglehold. Fingers like flexible iron bands locked around Grant's throat, the thumbs pressing against his larynx. A grin of triumph and exertion creased his face, and Grant growled from deep in his chest. The samurai had a great deal of experience in hand-to-hand fighting, but he hadn't ever pitted himself against someone like Grant. He brought up his forearms and knocked the samurai's hands away. At the same time, he drove a knee into Shoki's groin, and as he doubled over, folding in the direction of the pain, Grant brought his right fist down like a pile driver on the back of the man's neck. His face hit the floor first, followed a second later by his knees, then the rest of his body. Grant stood over him, panting and massaging his hand. He had broken a few knuckles before, and he was pretty sure he had done it again. Shizuka came to his side, her dark eyes wide with worry and a flickering gleam of anger.
Are you all right?
He shook his aching right hand.
You'd think after all this time I'd have learned to hit the soft parts.
Shizuka didn't laugh. She bent and wrestled Shoki onto his back. He wasn't a pretty sight. One eye was swollen shut, and his mouth and nostrils leaked blood. A couple of teeth lay on the floor in a little puddle of crimson. She jerked open his robe, lifted his left arm, and pointed to a tiny black figure tattooed in his armpit.
A black dragon! I knew he was hot-headed, but I never dreamed he would—
From somewhere in the vicinity of the palace, three gunshots cracked, sounding like firecrackers going off under a tin can. Wordlessly, Grant and Shizuka threw on their clothes. She took less time than he did. Carrying the Naginata, Grant followed Shizuka out of the bathhouse. They did not leave its shadow, because Shizuka suddenly went on one knee and gestured for Grant to do the same. They crawled up to a sculpted corner hedge and hazarded a quick look around it. In the gathering gloom, they saw many dark figures flitting across the lawn, moving in on the rear wall of the castle.
What the hell is going on?
The Black Dragons are staging a coup. I don't know if they intend to overthrow Lord Takaun, or merely bend him to their will, but the Tigers of Heaven can't allow either one to happen.
If you can take me to where you stored our weapons, I think we may be able to tip the scales in your favor.
The room is all the way on the other side of the fortress. It would be the miracle of miracles if we could reach it undetected.
Another cracking gunshot split the sunset. Grant craned to see around the corner of the bathhouse.
Somebody's got a working blaster in there. One guess who?
Shizuka regarded him with a searching stare.
Kane-san?
He smiled bleakly.
He'd be my first choice.
You mean he smuggled a firearm into the palace?
Yeah, I wish I'd have thought of that.
One more snapping report sounded. This one was followed by howls of pain. They eased closer and saw a man reeling across the lawn, clutching at his shoulder. Through an open gate came a surge of Tigers of Heaven, their armor glinting in the sunset. From almost every shadowed point on the lawn between the bathhouse and the castle rushed a horde of black-garbed dragons, wielding swords and lances. They struck the tigers from both flanks, pushing them toward the rear of the fortress. A resounding roar arose from the ranks of the black dragons. There was almost no room to maneuver, and the katanas of the black dragons penetrated chinks in the tigers' armor and sank deep into eyes through the slits in the visors. Screams blended in with the clash of steel on steel. The gloom lit up with little flares as blue sparks flew from impact points. Then, over the clash and clamor of battle, a new sound floated in on the warm sea breeze. It was the brazen tolling of a bell. It rang in a 3-1 pattern, and then repeated. Shizuka stiffened and stood, wheeling around to face the direction of the tolling. Grant tugged at her hand.
Get down, goddammit, they'll see you!
Shizuka struggled, wresting away from his grip.
No! The watchman! He's ringing the signal for Rakau!
Who's that?
Shizuka's eyes were suddenly wide and wild with terror.
Not who, a what? Invasion!
Lakesh gazed in awed fascination at the transparent sphere. 6 feet in diameter, it occupied the center of the room from floor to ceiling. At least, Lakesh assumed the room had a floor and ceiling, even if he couldn't see them. He had jumped from the Cerberus Redoubt with Erica and Sam without knowing their destination. The walls, ceiling, and floor of the room were such a total black, they seemed to absorb all light like a vast ebony sponge. Within the suspended globe glittered thousands of pinpoints of light, scattered seemingly at random, but all connected by glowing lines similar to the Redoubt's Mercator relief map that delineated all the functioning gateway units of the Cerberus network. But the map had never gripped his imagination like the sphere. It was as though he stood before the whole blazing, wheeling galaxy in miniature. He felt as if he were a disembodied spirit flying through interstellar space rather than standing in a room, looking at a three-dimensional representation of the electromagnetic power grid of the planet. Erica Van Sloan sidled up from the blackness, her satiny blouse rustling softly.
Impressive, isn't it? I thought at first it was a work of art.
In a way, it is. It's not just a geomantic map of Earth, but it's my entire field of study condensed and captured.
He gestured to the flickering points of light.
The power points of the planet, places that naturally generate specific types of energy. Some have positive and projective frequencies, others are negative and receptive.
Lakesh pointed to one glowing speck, brighter than the rest.
Chomolungma, in the Himalayas, Mount Everest. According to ancient lore, that vortex is the single most powerful point on the planet. The energy it radiates sustains life and spreads prana all over the globe.
Prana?
An old Sanskrit term, meaning in a general way, the world soul.
Was that what you were trying to spread with your quantum interface Mattrans inducers?
I was just trying to make quota. At the time, I didn't know I was going over ground already broken millennia before.
Lakesh had achieved his breakthrough in the Project Cerberus researches only by coming to the conclusion that matter transmission was absolutely impossible through the employment of Einsteinian physics. Only quantum physics, coupled with quantum mechanics, had made it work. But he was by no means the first to make this discovery.
I was attached to Operation Kronos, remember? It was your first successes with the Mattrans inducers that allowed us to pierce the Chronon stream.
I know. But every bit of totality concept technology was only a synthetic imitation of the power Balaam's folk tapped into and wielded. We were all frauds, you know.
He smiled bitterly. Lakesh still remembered his dismay and outright shock when, in his position of Project Cerberus Overseer, he had learned that quantum scientific principles by which the gateways operated were not a form of new physics at all, but a rediscovery of ancient knowledge. Erica took his hand.
They're ready for you.
Lakesh resisted a moment, surprised by how strong she was.
Who? Sam? Or Balaam?
She smiled seductively.
Come with me and find out.
Lakesh had no idea where they were. When he asked if they were in Agartha, where Cain and Brigid had left Balaam, neither of his companions gave him a definite answer. Regardless, he sensed they were deep underground, beneath inestimable tons of rock. More than half an hour before, he, Sam, and Erica materialized in a gateway unit with rich golden walls, as if ingots had been melted down and applied to the armorglass like molten paint. Outside the chamber was a stone-block-walled, low-ceilinged corridor. The location was of secondary importance as far as Lakesh was concerned. If Erica and Sam had wanted to kill him, they could have done so during the many hours he spent alone with them in the Cerberus Redoubt. They certainly would not have had to cajole, argue, and finally plead with him to accompany them on a Mattrans jaunt. Most of his questions about Balaam, Sam's origins, and particularly Erica's restored youth had been neatly deflected. They wanted his involvement, but they refused to reveal anything but tantalizing scraps of information. Lakesh couldn't help but be intrigued. He was suspicious of both of them, especially Erica, but she answered all of his questions about the inner workings of the totality concept and the personnel involved without hesitation. The forebears of Balaam's people possessed the knowledge of hyperdimensional physics. The so-called Archons shared this knowledge in piecemeal fashion with the scientists of the totality concept. But they had kept to themselves the knowledge that the gateways could accomplish far more than linear travel from point to point along a quantum channel. Project Cerberus and Operation Kronos were all aspects of the same mechanism, only the applications of the principle differed. It had occurred to Lakesh that perhaps the entire undertaking had been codenamed the totality concept because it encompassed the totality of everything, the entire workings of the universe. Of course, the human scientists and military officials involved in the endeavor were too fixated on reaching short-term goals, making quota, and earning bonuses to devote much thought to the workings of the universe, or even where the basic components to build the first Mattrans unit had come from. Lakesh included himself in this number, although he hadn't been so much fixated as blinded to the disastrous consequences that could result from the totality concept's myriad divisions. Before and after the nuke cost, he had studied the body of scientific theory that claimed megalithic structures such as the dolmens of Newgrange in Ireland and Stonehenge in England were expressions of an old, long-forgotten system of physics. The theory, based on hyperdimensional mathematics, provided a fundamental connection between the four forces of nature, an up-and-down link with invisible higher dimensions. Evidence indicated there were many natural vortex points, centers of intense energy on Earth and even other celestial bodies in the solar system. Lakesh became convinced that some ancient peoples were aware of this and could manipulate these symmetrical Earth energies to open portals not just for linear travel like the gateways, but perhaps into other realms of existence. He suspected the knowledge was suppressed over the centuries, an act of repression he believed was the responsibility of the Archons or the secret societies in their service. To test the theory, Lakesh saw to the construction of a miniaturized version of a Mattrans unit, utilizing much of the same hardware and operating principles. He called it an interfacer, and like the gateways, the interfacer functioned by tapping into the quantum stream. Although the interfacer opened dimensional rifts, as did the gateways, he envisioned using the gaps as a transit tunnel through the gaps in normal space-time. The instrument was designed to interact with a natural vortex's quantum energy and create an intersection point, a discontinuous quantum jump. The device worked, but in ways he hadn't dreamed. Lakesh had always wanted to discuss the phenomenon with Balaam, but the entity had refused to reveal any of his people's secrets outright. When Balaam left his custody, he had despaired of ever learning anything more. Now it appeared he had a second chance. Both Sam and Erica were adept at teasing him with hints and inferences about an undertaking that would forever change the nuke-scarred face of the planet. At length, he accepted she was who she claimed to be, and he agreed to accompany them to their unnamed destination, where not only Balaam awaited him, but also where he would find answers to his questions. Over the strenuous and profane objections put forth by DeFore, Bry, and even Banks, Lakesh entered a set of coordinates provided by Erica in the gateway's keypad, and away they went. He felt a little guilty about leaving Cerberus while the fates of Domi and Cain were still unknown, but both Erica and Sam vowed to return him in 12 hours. He believed them, and he didn't know why. Although he experienced a strong physical attraction for the woman, he found it required a great deal of mental effort to refuse Sam anything or question anything he said. The boy possessed exceptionally strong powers of persuasion, and whether it was just charisma or something else, Lakesh was completely charmed by him. Actually, he was more than charmed. He trusted him and felt protective of him in a paternal way. To his everlasting regret, Lakesh had never married or fathered children. The closest he came to producing offspring was when he rifled the Vil's genetic records to find desirable qualifications in order to build a covert resistance movement against the baronies. He used the baron's own fixation with purity control against them. By his own confession, he was a physicist, cast in the role of an archivist, pretending to be a geneticist, manipulating a political system that was still in a state of flux. Cain was one such example of that political and genetic manipulation. Erica Van Sloan strode purposefully down the passageway, taking long-legged strides, her boot heels clacking in a steady rhythm against the stone floor. Lakesh could not reconcile his memories of the withered, crippled old hag with the tall, vibrant, and beautiful woman he followed. He shook his head a little remorsefully as he watched the sensuous twitch of her buttocks beneath the tight jodhpurs. She had a body built for sex, and if she was attempting to entice him with her restored youth and vitality, it was a cruel game. Erica stepped through an open doorway. Lakesh followed her and came to a halt, blinking owlishly at the furnishings of the room. It wasn't so much the lavish appointments that startled him as the sensation of stepping back in time several thousand years into a central clearinghouse of several ancient cultures. A tall, round, sandstone pillar bearing ornate carvings of birds and animal heads was bracketed by two large sculptures, one a feathered jaguar and the other a serpent with wings. Silken tapestries depicting Asian ideographs hung from the walls. There were other tapestries, all bearing flowing geometric designs. Suspended from the ceiling by thin steel wires was a huge gold disc in the form of the Rey Horakhte falcon. The upcurving wings were inlaid with colored glass. The sun disc atop the beaked head was a cabochon-cut carnelian. Ceramic effigy jars and elegantly crafted vessels depicting animal-headed gods and goddesses from the Egyptian pantheon were stacked in neat pyramids. Arrayed on a long shelf on the opposite wall were a dozen Ushabtis figures, small statuettes representing laborers in the land of the dead. Against the right wall was a granite 12-foot-tall replica of the seated figure of Ramses III. It towered over a cluster of dark basalt blocks inscribed with deep rune markings. A huge, gilt-framed mirror, at least 10 feet tall and 5 wide, stood amid stacks of weaponry, swords, shields, and lances. A spearhead with a single drop of blood on its nicked point rested on a table. The center and corners of the floor were crammed with artifacts from every possible time, every culture, Inca, Maya, China, Egypt, and others Lakesh could not quickly identify. He wasn't even sure if he wanted to, since he had believed some of the relics were pure myth, such as the mirror of Prester John and the Spear of Destiny. Each and every item appeared to be in perfect condition. The huge room was an archaeologist's paradise. Lakesh struggled to comprehend the enormity of the collection and why it was here. Finally, he realized it was a representative sampling from every human culture ever influenced by the race he knew as Archons. He looked around, trying to find Balaam in the collection. For an instant, he thought he spotted him, then realized it was only a statue that closely resembled him. Standing in an erect position, less than 5 feet tall, the sculpture represented a humanoid creature with a slender, gracile build draped in robes. The features were sharp, the domed head disproportionately large and hairless. The eyes were huge, slanted, and fathomless. Cradled in its six-fingered hands was what appeared to be a human infant. Lakesh repressed a shudder and nearly jumped straight up when he felt a light touch on his arm. He spun clumsily to see Sam beaming up at him.
You took 10 years off my life, and at my age I can ill afford to squander even an hour of it.
Sam's cherubic smile broadened.
Perhaps we'll do something about that, Mohandas.
Lakesh felt a distant unease at the uncomfortable way the boy called him by his first name, but he didn't comment on it.
Where is Balam?
You'll see him, once you're convinced.
Lakesh used his best authoritarian tone.
Convinced of what, young man?
Of who I am. Of the energies flowing through me.
Erica stepped up to Lakesh and caressed his deeply seamed cheek with cool, soft fingers.
You've been consumed with curiosity about how Sam restored me, haven't you?
Among other things. Least of all, why you refer to him as your son.
First things first, Mohandas. Secrets must be revealed in the order of their importance.
Secrets?
The first secret is energy. It always has been, always will be. The science of moving it in precise harmony and in perfect balance, harmonizing it with other forms of energy.
Lakesh bobbed his head in irritated impatience.
You're not telling me anything I haven't spent my entire adult life studying.
Perhaps. But studying and understanding all the principles and applications are often very different things.
Lakesh bristled at the boy's patronizing tone. He drew on an untapped reservoir of strength and managed to work himself up to a high state of annoyance, despite Sam's powers of persuasion.
Demonstrate what you mean or I'm leaving.
The corners of Sam's mouth turned down in a frown.
You've come too far to dictate terms, Mohandas. I want you to understand what I am. I am an avatar.
Chill fingers of dread stroked the buttons of Lakesh's spine.
An avatar of what?
There must be an order to things. If war is necessary for that order to be established, then I am willing to wage it. But you must teach me certain things. Make me more than I am.
I know nothing of war.
But you know deception, do you not? Is not all war based on deception, on misdirection and misinformation?
Lakesh dredged his memory and came up with a quote from Sun Tzu.
Use deception when you have not the power to win in open battle.
Exactly. You have followed that philosophy in your war against the Baronies. I can learn much from you.
And if you win your war, what kind of order do you intend to build?
One where the old humans and the new humans rally around me, the bridge between both, and coexist peacefully.
Lakesh gazed into the boy's eyes of many colors and felt a little ill and frightened. He sensed the king's robes around the child, even if he could not see them. But he also sensed Sam was either cursed or blessed with something outside the pale of normal humanity, or inhumanity.
Coexist under your single authority?
Sam's frown deepened as if he were irritated by Lakesh stating the obvious.
Of course! I thought you understood that.
I understand, Sam. You're just another damn megalomaniac. Another mutie with an attitude.
He turned toward the door.
I don't know what powers you have, but it's obvious you lured me here under the pretense of a meeting with Balam. He's not and probably never has been here. You disappoint me.
Lakesh caught only a glimpse of Sam making a flicking hand gesture. Then Erica Van Sloan was on him, securing a hammerlock on his right arm and wrenching it up between his shoulder blades. She kicked the backs of his knees and his legs buckled. Crying out in pain and outrage, Lakesh collapsed. Only Erica's surprising strength prevented him from falling on his face. She murmured into his ear.
I'm sorry about this, Mohandas, but you'll thank me when it's over.
He struggled, but she cinched down even tighter on his captured arm.
When? What is over?
Sam stepped toward him, pulling back the belled right sleeve of his robe.
When I'm finished moving energy in precise harmony and perfect balance.
Sam spread his right hand wide and laid it against Lakesh's midriff. From it seeped a tingling warmth. Ice seemed to melt his body, and he felt painfully searing heat like liquid fire rippling through his veins and arteries. His heartbeat picked up in tempo, seeming to spread the heart through the rest of his body, a pulsing web of energy suffusing every separate cell and organ. He squeezed his eyes shut. Lakesh's lungs gave a jerking, labored spasm as they sucked in air involuntarily, expanding so much in his chest he feared his ribs would break. His mouth opened and a scream came forth, but his voice was not reedy or strained. The cry was a full-bodied utterance of pain. He was aflame with it, the same kind of agony a man feels when circulation is suddenly restored to a numb limb. His back arched, and for the first time in more than 50 years, he felt a stirring in his loins. His entire metabolism seemed to awaken to furious life from a long slumber, as if he had been jump-started by a powerful battery. The heat faded from his body, and he sagged within Erica's grip, panting and sweating. She released him, and he caught himself on his hands. Slowly, Lakesh opened his eyes. They burned slightly, feeling somewhat sticky, but his vision was not blurred or fogged. He tried to push himself up, but his body felt like a foreign thing, and it moved sluggishly.
Careful now, Mohandas. Take it easy at first.
Carefully, Erica helped him to his feet. His legs wobbled like those of a newborn foal. When he raised a hand to wipe away the film of perspiration on his face, he realized two things more or less simultaneously. He wasn't wearing his glasses, but he could see his hand perfectly. By that perfect vision, he saw the flesh of his hand was smooth, the prominent veins having sunk back into firm flesh. The liver spots faded away even as he watched. Wildly, Lakesh stumbled toward the huge mirror. He nearly fell twice, but Erica helped him along. He stood before it, stupefied into silence. The face, reflected in its glossy surface, bore little resemblance to the one that looked as if he had borrowed it from a cadaver. His hair, though still thin, was not ash gray, but an iron color. It seemed to darken with every passing second. Uttering a wordless cry of wonder, Lakesh brought his hands up to his cheeks, his fingertips exploring the smooth, unseamed flesh. A voice spoke from behind him, hoarse, faint, and scratchy.
Now we will speak of the future, Mohandas Lakesh Singh.
The familiar voice sent cold prickles up and down his backbone. Slowly, he turned, keeping his expression as neutral and composed as possible. A figure stood beside Sam, dressed in a similar robe. Lakesh gazed without blinking at the high, domed cranium that narrowed to an elongated chin. The faint grayish-pink skin was stretched drum-tight over a structure of facial bones that seemed all cheek and brow, with little in between but two great upslanting eyes like black pools. The slit of a mouth held the faintest suggestion of a smile.
Yes, Balam, we must speak of the future. And my place in it.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terence Aselford. With performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, and Colleen Delaney. Outlanders number 16. Tigers of Heaven. Book 2 of the Imperator Wars trilogy.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.